With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Forensic Psychology is a podcast that provides an illuminating window into the workings of the criminal mind. Now, here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we have a great guest, Darwin Casey Diaz. He's a native of El Salvador and a former gang leader. He grew up in the mean streets of LA. He was forced to fight for his life. He was eventually incarcerated as one of the most violent criminals in California and placed in solitary confinement. His life was forever changed, though, in that cell. We're going to find out why it changed. The reason, according to his book, was one day God approached Casey in a miraculous way. And we're going to find out about that story and more. You can catch his book, which I highly recommend. It was a great read. It's called The Shot Caller, a Latino gangbanger's miraculous escape from a life of violence to a new life in Christ. And you'll find out what dangers this put Casey Diaz in. Before we get started, make sure to share, subscribe, and hit that like button. Oh, by the way, he also has a podcast called The Shot Caller, if you want to check that out. So let's not waste any more time. Welcome to the show, Casey Diaz. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. Again, and folks, yes, I do read the books when the authors come onto the show. And I just finished this book last night, and it was an amazing read. You have an amazing story, my friend. Really amazing story. I guess we'll start off with this. You had a very difficult upbringing. A challenging one that I've seen a lot of times with a lot of members of gangs that have similar stories in some cases, with physical abuse, neglect, all these things. Tell us a little bit about that if you can, and then we'll start going into what got you into gangs and things of that nature.
Well, you know, it started very innocently. I grew up in the 70s. Born in 72. And so the whole part of the 70s for me as a kid was normal. You know, we went outside. It was still the generation that, I think it was probably the last generation to be outside and play. And, you know, before Atari even stepped in and video game, era started. So we went outside as kids still and play baseball and football and rock fights, and that's what we had. And so it was just
that too.
Yeah, it was just innocent kid stuff. And but I noticed that right off the bat, even as a kid, that many of my friends that I'm growing up with at that time, it was only one family that had a dad physically there. Wow. at their home. And there must have been maybe, I want to say, a good 15 to 20 of us kids that lived in a mile radius. And we all hung out, you know, outside after school. And like I said, it was just sports. It was, you know, innocent stuff. But I took notice. And I think that some of the other kids around the neighborhood also took notice of that. And we used to call them the Pet Boys because it was all brothers, you know, it was a handful of brothers, and we just called them the Pet Boys. And I actually reunited with them after 30 something years about a few weeks ago.
Really? Manny Moe?
Yeah. So that was pretty neat, you know, seeing each other as adults, and they had heard about, where I took all the whole, the wrong road and where it took me. But we had a great reunion, but that's basically how I grew up. And you look at some of the stuff that as a child, And you kind of think, well, this is normal because this is all you see is there's drugs right outside the door and there's gang members. But you're really not paying, you know what's there, but you're not paying attention to that because you still have that. I believe that there was still innocence within our little group of kids. You know, and then, of course, the 80s came around and breakdancing and all that stuff and graffiti. That started coming along in Los Angeles, and then things start to turn a little bit because now, you know, the gang culture starts to step in, and well, it sticks its ugly nose, and it's enticing to kids that, well, where there's no dad, there's no leader, there's no a good example or role model, and the streets start to look pretty good, and that gang culture. Look, it almost makes sense to go ahead and join because you have older gang members and all that stuff. Well, but early on in my life, it was just being a kid, man.
You know, it's interesting because when I was reading your book, I was like, he grew up, I was born in 71 and I grew up in Panorama City. So reading your book, I was like, well, wait a minute. I know some of these neighborhoods. This was kind of like weird flashbacks going on there. I think you even made one comment in the book about gangs from LA compared to gangs in San Fernando Valley and how they weren't looked upon the same way. I was like, yeah, I never knew that part. But you're absolutely right, because when you're children, you don't pay attention. There was gangs around me and Panorama, and I didn't think much of it. Now, we did grow up differently because my dad was home. So he definitely put the hammer down in regards to that. And that makes a big difference. It seems like you almost matured a little too early too, because you saw a lot of things in your book when you were really young. And I think even before 10, you saw things because people, you made a comment a minute ago where you said how different things were back then. We used to play outside a lot and people didn't worry so much of being children being kidnapped. And yet you did see some of that at a very early age, if I remember.
Yeah, I got to witness two kidnappings. One was a little boy, a little Hispanic boy on my way to school. And another one was a little Korean girl. And there were, it must have been months apart or maybe a year apart. I witnessed it right in front of my face. And, you know, those kind of things... leaves a mark in your memory bank of how the world isn't so pleasant to be in. And there's people that are just flat out evil and will do anything to the point of even, you know, kidnapping children. But I saw that. I also saw in my book, I share, witnessing a triple murder. And I was about 8 years old around that time. So, you know, you ask the average kid, you know, what their memory looks like, you know, growing up, let's say in Burbank. Well, they're not going to, those aren't the memories that they're going to capture. It's a suburb. It's different. But yeah, those are the things that I think could start to mold a different outlook of life as you grow on. And yeah, you know, when you're living in that kind of environment, you tend to grow up a lot faster than the average kid. The streets start to become your teacher really fast.
That's a great point. And the sad thing, I remember reading in your book that at the young age of 8 or 9, we don't understand the world at that age. And you weren't even able to discuss this with your dad. I think you felt like he wouldn't care. Your mom wouldn't. So you really didn't get the guidance of an adult to say, let me explain what's going on. There's evil people out there, blah, blah, blah. That wasn't even there for you, if I'm right.
There wasn't, you know. I have a 12-year-old boy now. I'm an open book with him. He can talk to me about anything. I got two older daughters as well. But and I've been able to... not having a dad has, I don't want to say has helped me, because I think that's so important to have a dad, in the family unit. But I think that as an adult now, I know that it was important for me to open up to my kids very early on and have them know and understand that they can approach me about anything in life. And, back then, a lot of parents didn't talk about certain things. Certainly sex was out of the way. It was like a taboo, and it wasn't even discussed in the family unit. That was learned on a street base. My parents never talked to me about absolutely anything.
About drugs?
Drugs? They didn't talk to me about drugs. One, because, my dad was already drug dealing. That was... what is he going to talk to me about? How to deal him? I don't know. Yeah. But that wasn't discussed. I ended up learning that he was drug dealing by just snooping around the apartment that we lived in and running across a stash of drugs that he had copped and was hiding them in a closet. And then, you hear the discussions with my mom and him going to jail and stuff like that for that. Back then, drug offenses were a slap on the wrist and you were out. It wasn't what it is now. Even now, I think we're going backwards on that issue as well.
That's a whole another story for another show.
Exactly.
Yeah, boy. What's interesting? When I was reading your book, I kept going, wow, this guy's really self-aware. Then, of course, I had to remember you wrote the book after everything happened. But still, the self-awareness you had, I've seen a lot of individuals, this isn't to minimize your story whatsoever, but I've seen a lot of individuals who overcome challenges like yourself, but they usually have a mentor. And I didn't see that. And I don't know, we're going to get to the part in prison and we'll learn about that story too. But did you have a mentor early on in life, or at least anybody you looked up to, whether it was in TV, whether it was an uncle or anything at all, or no?
No, but now looking as an adult and looking back, there was right before we get into what I was sentenced for in the Hall of Nerds, there was a lady who to this day I've been looking for. And this is right up to where I commit this crime that sends me in into adult prison. This lady, her name was Mrs. Escalante, just like the guy version. She was the girl version of the guy on that movie Stand By Me. I mean, they had the same last name, and her name was Janet Escalante. I've been looking for her all this time because she was the first person, and I wasn't paying attention to that back then, but I was about, 15, 16. And I was at what's called the Metropolitan Skill Center. It was a continuation school for, kids that were, wayward. And I remember I had just came out of a camp, of a probation camp. And this lady was bent that I would graduate high school and that I would become somebody. And there was a moment, I didn't talk about this on the book, but there was a moment that where she was actually going to my apartment on her off time and helping me with homework. I never mentioned this. And actually, this would be considered an exclusive part of the interview to you because never shared this before. But she would, I remember her in a classroom, and this is a room filled with gang members. I mean, this is a classroom and about 20 of us, 18 of us are probably all gang members. And she says to the whole classroom, I remember this, I'll never forget this. She said, Casey, you're going to graduate. You're going to graduate high school. I'm going to make sure that you graduate. And everybody, we all laughed and, mocked at that statement. And she went out of her way and helped me to finish high school. She would come after school, help me with homework. And then she had a best friend that was a deputy sheriff for Los Angeles. Hmm. And she asked me one day, she says, I want you to talk to her. She wants to talk to you. And I I looked at her and I said, well, for what? And she says, well, she just wants to talk to you. Give her a chance. And I remember they came over on a Saturday. They didn't tell nobody. They came to my apartment. I agreed to the meeting. And she was willing to help me after graduation and mentor me going into the Sheriff's Academy and all in yards. And of course, well, we know the book doesn't tell you that, but
yeah,
those were two people that came into my life right before I messed up really bad.
Wow. So you had something inside of you that they saw. And that's the unique thing about it. Yeah, it's interesting because, again, your story is fascinating to me because I saw that part. It threw me off in the book when I saw the part about you graduated high school and you got your, it was like, wait a minute. And then he goes into college and he continues to get more units in college. And I'm thinking, okay, this isn't, I'm missing a part here that I'm not getting. It's like, how did you have that motivation to do that? Because it doesn't usually work that way. Usually people drop out at 16, 17. They don't go to high school. Definitely not going to go to college and they stay with the gang life. But you seem like to almost have one foot here and one foot there. Like you almost weren't completely 100% committed to your gang life. Am I wrong or?
No, you know what? This teacher came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting adult. And, you know, of course, when you're a kid and you're involved in that type of, you know, culture as the gang culture, you're not thinking straight. You're not thinking, the value. You're not seeing the value of an adult actually seeing something inside of you that you don't see. And, you know, because all I've ever heard was, you know, negative things said about me by my own father and other relatives and stuff like that. So to me, you know, this was strange and I didn't see what she saw. I ended up getting all my credits a whole lot earlier than I should have. I didn't walk the stage because I ended up getting arrested right before. So I was able to take the graduation pictures but didn't make it to the graduation because of my arrest.
Now, why did you go to college?
Inside, while I was inside.
Oh, that's right. Well, you're inside. You went to college. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I remember reading about your dad. You know, I don't remember this part of the book. I'm getting older, folks. Do you have siblings?
I have one. We're 11 years apart. I have a brother. Yeah. And I don't mention him in the book at all.
Yeah. Is he older or younger?
He's younger.
Okay. And the reason I ask is sometimes that could be a mentor as well, but he's too young.
Yeah.
And one thing I always like to make sure people realize, no matter how many years apart you are, you don't usually have the same parents. Once parents have a second kid, things start changing.
Yeah.
And shoot, even as years go by, parents change themselves. They're human beings.
Yeah.
So 11 years is a lot.
That's a big difference. That's a big gap.
It's a big gap. Yeah. Because your dad would have been a lot older by that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's do this. I know you have a lot of criminal activity, so we won't go through all of that. But maybe we'll kind of speed through a little bit of it. What was the very first crime you committed? If I could ask, what did you think about? And then maybe we'll start heading into the more serious crimes later.
I think that, well, the first ones, I talk about my childhood friend, Jason. His name's Miguel, I believe we changed it. And I had a reunion with Jason recently. So I got to find him through Facebook. And that was pretty cool. We talked, we had lunch and stuff. So me and him, we had sticky fingers, man. And we started stealing from 7-Eleven, just candy bars and stuff like that. I remember we would walk into 7-Eleven with Slurpees and we'd go to the candy aisle and open up the Slurpee. We would throw candies in there, Snickers, M&Ms and all that stuff. And then we would go to the Slurpee station and fill it up. We'd have a cup full of all kinds of goodies. And back then they gave you a big old Slurpee cup. So a lot fit in there and we'd fill it in and then go in there and put the Slurpee over it and walk out laughing because we just, you know, stole, you know, $10 worth of candies or whatever it was. But those are the first ones. Eventually, I ended up getting the car and all that kind of thing. But you know, it starts very with very small items, you develop. It's almost like it's intriguing. The sneakiness and all that starts to it does something to your brain that you start to go, okay, well, I got away with that. What else can I get away with? And I think that, you know, I might not have said that, but I think that that's where your heart goes or your mind goes, that if I can get away with this, what else can I get away with? I was stealing money from my mom's purse or little pocketbook, a couple of dollars here and there that, you know, and, you know, you cross, I think you start crossing lines that you didn't think you would ever cross. You know, or it just didn't matter to you. For me, it didn't matter. It just, you know, what else can I get? So candy was the first thing that was on the menu as far as crime.
The menu.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. So, I mean, my background, that's what I study, is criminal behavior. So I have an interesting question for you. Psychologically, I can see that, definitely. I can see the intoxication that can come from stealing and the high of it. Did it also provide you, and this might sound weird, but did it provide you with a level of something I can do successfully, something that can boost your self-esteem? Since your dad did always kind of tear you down, and here you are stealing, not your mom's purse, that's independent of that, but stealing from stores and then graduating to bigger items. Did you feel like I'm accomplishing something or no?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, then you start seeing your other friends, and they're doing about the same thing that you're doing. And each one, I think each one of us was trying to outdo the next person. So well, you stole that, or you broke into that house, or I'm going to go and steal a car. And, you know, and so I learned how to steal a car very early on. I never did a burglary. I had a disdain for that. I had no problem being sneaky in other things in public, but I just didn't see it. I didn't see it like a cool thing to do, to break into somebody's house. So I never did a burglary. I didn't see a problem with sticking, a knife or a screwdriver or a gun on somebody's face and then taking their stuff. For some reason, that was justifiable to me at that time. You could see it, looking back as an adult now, I could see the gradual effect that it kept having, because you do feel like, well, now I did this and now I've graduated. You know, I remember one time we stole so many cars that we had them all parked along the street that we lived in. And I think we had, I stole, I don't know, maybe 14 cars or something like that.
Holy cow.
And they were all Toyota Corollas. And we would laugh because I had parked them all in the line. If you were paying attention, you'd see, you know, 13, 14 Toyota Corollas all in line, wrapping around the corner. And, that kind of thing. And, you know, then the next guy wants to do, you know, a 15th Toyota Corolla to up his game, you know, that kind of, so yeah, you see the pattern that, it's almost like a false sense of success that is created within your own, you know, way of thinking, I guess.
Yeah. It's fascinating to hear it. It's exactly right. It's a competition between you guys and you finding somewhat of an identity in something you're good at. I hate to frame it that way, but that's what it is. I mean, 15 cars, you're obviously not a chump in stealing cars. It's a lot of cars. I want to fast forward a little bit, because then you get into a really powerful part of the book too, which was the first time you ended up stabbing somebody. And I think the distinction there, you kind of highlighted it in your book a little bit when you mentioned this was an opposing gang member. You know, and I can kind of see the difference there between a burglary, where a burglary is an innocent victim, you have no idea who this is, and you're taking something away from them. And they have no reason really for that. Now how that's different from a car, I don't know. Maybe it's a car insurance thing. I don't know. It's funny, you know, people can do whatever they can with rationalizing things away.
Yeah.
But what did you, I don't know if you want to share that part again. I know it's in your book. The Shot Caller, folks, is the name of the book by Casey Diaz. That was a pretty powerful moment in your life. Did it scare you at all that you could even do that?
I think at first it you know, when it's happening, because it's not like it was planned, in a sense of, you know, it didn't take weeks to plan this. It was one of those, we were there, and this older gang member has a Toyota. I remember it was a Toyota. It was one of those first, I guess you would call it a SUV type of car from back in the days. And it was like a, it had a hat, like a hatchback, I guess.
It was like a station wagon?
Kind of, but it was a modern version of the old 70s looking one. This is the 80s version of it. I mean, I see a picture. I still remember it. It was a gold one. I remember the stripes on the side. I still remember it very vividly. But he came to the neighborhood in that stolen car and grabbed me, and you know, he said, "Hey, come on, you know, come with me." And I got in the car, and to me, it was like, it was the adrenaline, man. You know, here it is. I'm way younger. I'm the youngest guy in this gang at this moment, and this guy that everybody looks at or looks up to is favoring me and telling me, "Hey, come with me." And we got into this car, and I remember him driving down the alleys, man, and he was gunning it. I mean, I think if I was afraid of anything, it was afraid of we're gonna die in this car, because he's not even stopping between alleys, you know. Oh. So he's just going, man. He's just going, and we're, you know, from alley to alley, there's the little ramps, you know, that they become ramps because at that speed, you're getting some air. And so we went through alleys, and we're, you know, he's laughing and I'm nervous laughing, you know, you don't want to look like a little punk either. So, you know, there was a nervous laugh from me. I know that. I don't know if he smelled that or he took notice of that, but it was a nervous laugh. I mean, and it was just having to do with, we're going to crash. and then he kind of slows it down and he says, "Yeah, we're going to go looking for so-and-so and we're going to handle some business." And we found the guy that he was looking for, and a fight ensued. And the next thing I know, he's stabbing this guy. And then while he's doing that and he's overpowering him, he's already on the floor and he's been stabbed quite a bit. He just hands me the screwdriver and says, "Your turn." And there's not a, it's not like you could, there's no pause button to tap at that moment and say, "Hey, can we talk about this over, you know, over some lunch?" That just doesn't happen. You're either going to say yes or no, and it's better for you to say yes than to say no. And he handed it to me, and that was, you know, I was 11 years old, and it was my first stabbing.
Now I know. Go ahead.
It's even to this day, you know, there's sometimes when I talk about certain incidents that crimes that I committed, that turned my stomach, you know, as a believer, it has an effect on me because it was a gang member, but it was also a human being that we hurt, very bad. But you know, I was 11 years old when my first, you know, quote unquote, my first serious crime took place, where someone got violently stabbed.
And I'll bring up another question I have for you later. I think during the time when you met God, we'll talk a little bit about that, because I think I don't think people sometimes realize what they're capable of. And we all have a dark side inside of us, right? Mm-hmm. And being able to control that is a very different type of a ball game. Have you ever looked back and wondered why he chose you at 11 years of age or whatever it was at the time?
I've asked that question to myself, I don't know, thousands of times, you know, why is it that he picked me? why is it that that he, I hate to call it favored, but I guess that's what the word that you could actually use. And I don't know why. I don't know why he selected me out of a bunch and said, hey, you know, you're gonna roll with me. And just because I was, you know, his little road dog there, the respect of the rest of the gang, really, it affected me very early because, wow, why does Rabbit hang out with this little dude? You know, and that influence came upon me where the rest of the gang members saw me different. And I could see that. I could see that there was this almost like this idolization that took place just because I was hanging out with him and just because he handpicked me to, you know. And I think it has a lot to do with, you know, validation, right? I think many kids, you know, I mean, there's adults that are looking to get validated, and they do, they get into the wrong things just because they want to get validated by, you know, a community or a group or a club and all this this stuff. So for me, that validation coming from him, you know, from an older gang member, and he wasn't all that much older neither. When I look at it now, he, you know, he's about 5 years older than me, something like that. So not much older, but, you know, this guy's already committing, you know, some serious crimes himself to where he has that title and everybody respects this guy. Yeah, you didn't cross him because he had no breaks. You become whoever you end up hanging out with, that's what you become. I mean, that's just in naturally in life, I think. You know, you hang out with that kind of person, you mimic that kind of activity. And, you know, unfortunately for me, that was what it did to me is I just copied what he did. And then I started liking the fear that was in the eyes of other gang members. And then of course, you know, the pat on the back from them, you know, and it's horrible, but that is what it did in my personal life.
I know when I've studied gang life, and you can correct me if we're wrong here, a lot of times your gang has become your surrogate family.
Oh yeah.
And these elders are your surrogate dads a lot of times. I mean,
you're looking at they replace your father figure in your life. They become that, you know, you might not see it at the moment, but that is what they become. That is your father, your street father, I guess. And, you know, you respond to them and you respect them, and what they tell you to do, you do it. It's a very, dark place to be in. And as a child, you just don't see the harm that is ahead of you when you're partaking of these activities.
Yeah, and I remember, and they know what they're doing. The recruiters, The recruiters know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a tragic thing. And it's funny because you have a recurring theme, and the recurring theme is whoever side it's on kept seeing something in you. If it wasn't this Rabbit, I think was his name.
Yeah.
Whatever the name you gave him, Rabbit. And then Escalante, the person in the prison, the person outside the prison, the INS agent, I think it was. Yeah. You always had somebody that kept seeing something in you. And it was really amazing when I kept reading the book. I was like, he's got something. He's got something to keep picking up on. And I don't know what it is. That's why I was really excited about doing the interview today, because I was wanting to keep probing that and trying to find out what is that something. That's why I keep wondering. I can't see Casey being that completely committed to that world. He liked what he liked from it, but I don't know. It just always seemed like something else was going on. So at that point, again, folks, we're only going to touch the tip of the iceberg. It's not Casey will be here like for 5 hours, but you left that part. You did some other crimes. And then we'll get to the most serious crimes. I know you had quite a bit of an adventure in the different jails and prisons, but what was the crime that eventually ended your time in freedom here?
It was a second-degree murder. So at 16, I'm in this little hole in the wall in Los Angeles. I have a stolen car. I'm in a burger joint. I get recognized by a rival gang who walks into this little hole in the wall. A fight ensues, and I ran outside. I didn't have anything on me at this moment. And this is the time where, you know, back in the days, you were able to, there was no seatbelt laws. You could ride in back of your pickup truck. And a lot of, you know, if you went to, like, let's say Hollywood on Friday nights or Saturday nights, you saw pickup trucks and you know, teenagers, gang members, you name it, on the back of the bed of the truck. And there was no law. You could do that back then. And so this truck was filled with gang members from this gang, a rival gang. And, you know, they came in, they recognized me, and I was able to go to the car that I was in. And the guy that was chasing me, ran back at me, is the guy that ends up losing his life.
And then you were arrested. I think they had to find you. It took a little bit of time before they caught you. What were you thinking? Was that the very first time? I can't remember. Was that the very first time you went to jail? No, you went to jail before.
Yeah, I had been in juvenile hall since the age of 11.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So the first time you got used to it or something like that, if I remember.
Yeah, I had been through probation camps, every juvenile hall. So it wasn't my first visit at all. I was used to that. I don't think there was literally not one year where I didn't do a year from 11 years old. I was always in and out. So I'd do a year here or 7 months here. I'd get out for about 2 days and went back in, did another year. So, you know, there was a lot of spent time inside juvenile halls prior to that incident.
You made an interesting comment, because I know in the world of criminology, there's the concept of deterrence theory, right? So if you put you in the prison or threaten to put you in a prison, that's going to deter people from committing crimes. Obviously, we know it doesn't completely work. But you made an interesting comment that people sometimes have talked to me about in regards to gangs. You went to jail once, and you went to jail twice, and then you said, I don't care anymore. I've already been there, done that. It's not that big of a deal. And that was a comment that I've heard before in the past. Was that pretty accurate?
Yeah, you know, it became, you know, I interview on the podcast, on my podcast, I interview guys that did time with me and are just now getting it. And, you know, we all have this one thing in common, is that prior to changing our lifestyles you know, separating ourselves from the gang culture eventually, it was all fun and games. I mean, we didn't see it as something dangerous. We just saw it as something exciting. So going into juvenile halls, going into the California Youth Authority or a probation camp, that was like a little gladiator school that, you know, here we go, let's rock and roll, and fighting and getting your name, getting recognized in there. You know, that was, I mean, it was just fun and games to us. Asking that question to everyone that has done time with me as adults now, you know, I just interviewed a buddy of mine that did 28 years, and 15 of those years were in solitary confinement. And
wow.
The same response was, you know, it was fun. I mean, we literally were having fun at what we were doing while we were in these detention centers. And so going in there, it didn't matter. You know, court was a joke and so was jail. We were living a carefree life of the consequences. I don't think we ever cared about, you know, where we got 6 days or 6 years, just didn't matter.
Now, folks, again, like I said, I'm skipping around a lot because there's just a lot of material in the book, and you should definitely read it. It's a fascinating story. Casey, then we'll jump into
I lost your audio.
Sorry about that, folks. My audio is playing games with me. So you, at one point you were going into, when you went into after the second degree murder, you ended up moving up again pretty quickly in the ranks in a way, because you were made shot caller because the previous one, I think, either left or I can't remember exactly what happened to him. And that kind of caught you off guard too. You really didn't know, why am I being chosen for shot caller? Can you tell us why and what does it mean to be a shot caller anyway?
And for some reason, man, it was almost like I was a magnet for some kind of role of leadership in every institution that I went to. Looking back now as an adult, and what we could talk about that later on, but I think you're designed by God to do specific things. And I'm 100% certain that there was leadership inside of me all along, but because I didn't have the right mentorship and the right leadership, hovering over me, well, anything that you don't know how to use, you're going to misuse. And for me, it was that. I think it certainly wasn't a coincidence. It wasn't, it might have looked like that, but I just found myself in these leadership positions, whether it was in a probation camp or in juvenile halls. And then here, after I get, while I'm on trial, actually, I'm in Wayside, in the Los Angeles County Jail in by Magic Mountain here. And I get approached by, some other leaders there. And the next thing I know, I'm the one that holds every shank and responsible for any activity that goes on on my block. For those of you that don't know how the Los Angeles County Jail is framed, this is one of the largest county jails in the United States, and it holds some of the most violent men in these jails. So for me to be 18-ish and getting that kind of power and control over other people that are in there, for some of them are in there for similar crimes, but then you're selected as the guy that's gonna, sign off on some pretty important things. And again, you're in that position, and it's not like you're gonna go, hey guys, maybe that's not a good thing for me to do right now. Let's revisit that, 3 months from now. You don't have that convenience to do that. You're presented the option, and it's pretty much a handed, and it's not something when you ask them, what's a shot caller? What does that involve? It's something that you really don't want when you're in there, to be honest with you. It's an environment that is only made for certain people. There's many people that just, they're not made for that kind of environment, that kind of violence, because it's very vicious. It's very, I like to compare it, it's like a pit bull getting a hold of, a little chihuahua, and that chihuahua's not going to make it. I mean, not in the jaws of that pit bull. It just won't. And you had guys that, in any type of criminal, I don't care what it is, whether it's organized crime or just gangs in itself, somebody is always wanting that position. And they want it foolishly, not knowing that you really don't want that type of title upon your head, because you're a moving target. Somebody wants that position. Somebody is willing to, stab you in the back for that. And, does it come with perks? I guess you could call them that. There's a sense of very high respect, and I don't want to even call it respect. It's more of a fear than anything else. And as an individual, as an 18-year-old, and you're giving that kind of power, it can be very dangerous, because one decision from you can cost you your life, your own life, or the life of others around you, just because, well, you signed off on whether it's a hit or what we called hard candy, which is, you know, assigning a group of other convicts in there to beat someone almost to the point of death. So there's a lot of, I think a lot of it, too much power in the hands of someone that young. But
no, I can imagine people don't, that's a lot of responsibility, and it's a very dangerous responsibility because everybody's hunting for you to get that power role if they're where they want it. I know in the prison time you spent with the shot caller, now that, was that a Pitches? I can't remember what facility.
Yeah, it's called Pitches, but we call it Wayside.
Wayside.
Yeah, it's Pitches Detention Center.
And then from there, you were transferred, a lot. But you were transferred over to, I think it was Folsom?
New Folsom.
New Folsom, that's right. It was right when it changed, right?
Yeah, so the old Folsom from all the famous movies, Johnny Cash and all that, that's now, when I went in there, it was already a low-level yard. So it was a 1 and 2, so it was low minimum security. And then, but it's on the same road, on Prison Road. If you go up the hill from the old Folsom, then you'll come up with what's called Sacramento State Prison. But the inmates call it New Folsom because it's on the same road.
Okay. I'm having a little bit of technical difficulties, folks. I'm not sure if I'm actually always responding. Let's see. So you went there, and then that was, I think this is where it ends for you in the sense of what you were saying earlier with your friend, where going in was fun. I think the shot caller role probably also didn't make it as much fun. But I'm assuming when you went to Folsom, that seemed like it wasn't fun at all.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, you know, I, like I said, I interviewed quite a bit of some very big heavy hitters on my podcast, and we all share the same response. It, you know, we didn't show it. Going into these prisons that young, but every one of us said, you know, we messed up. As soon as you see that gate, man, you see those walls and you see the gunners and you see the seriousness of a level 4 yard prison, which is the highest level of security in the state of California. Something in the back of your mind goes, I screwed up, you know. I didn't use those words, but inside of you go, you screwed up now. You know, this is now the big leagues. This is where, you know, and then you get that little pep talk from the warden.
I ask you about that.
And you hear those words and you go, yeah, it's time to rock and roll. This is where you got to man up really quick. For me, I was escorted straight to an interview room and then to what's called a segregated housing unit of the prison, so solitary confinement, because of my points and the level of danger that I could pose upon the general population.
They were really high.
Yeah. So they weren't going to take any chance with someone with a jacket like mine and then putting me on mainline. They had to put me in solitary confinement right off the bat.
So it sounds like you almost, when the warden gave you that speech, you didn't think it was a bunch of hot air. It sounds like you really thought, oh, crap.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, you're hearing him say, some of you are going to die because you have life sentences in this prison yard, and some of you are going to die because you're just stupid. You know, you hear those words and you go, yeah, all right, here we go. You know, this is the real deal. And, you know, places like New Folsom State Prison, Pelican Bay, and the Corcoran Shoe at that time, those were your Ivy League prisons. You know, those are the ones where that housed organized crime members and leaders. And you made sure that you walked a thin line and whatever needed to be done, you were going to partake of that. Period. You had no choice at that point. That, you know, this is a this is real now. This is very real. You know, and Even and I go to these speaking engagements, man, and educate the public in schools, and whether it's public schools, I go to universities. I do a lot of speaking engagements with law enforcement and churches, and I try to let them know that just because you have somebody locked up in an 8x10 cell, you would be surprised at the level of crime that takes place from an isolated shoe cell. There's moves that are being made in solitary confinement that, millions of dollars are, being shuffled here and there, and people are getting killed by someone's signature in a solitary confinement cell. So these are real things that happen, and it's just a different world, man. You got to be made for that.
Yeah, people don't, no knock on them, I guess. It's people don't understand. Because when I've talked to people or students in the past, and they're going to be drug-free in there. Nah, not necessarily. Probably not.
No.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I'm assuming the million-dollar things you're talking about, probably cell phones that get in there and COs that sometimes get bought out or threatened in some capacity.
Yeah, you know, when I was in there, there was no cell phones, but, we were moving a large quantity of a lot of things. It was, and we were using the CO mailing room to do that. This stuff that, the public doesn't know that, but we were using the staff mail room to both bring things in and ship things out. I'll share maybe some of it with you on this interview if we get to that portion of it. But, the public needs to know that people that are housed in segregated housing units, it's for a reason, and it's for the safety of other inmates, because you're not in solitary confinement for being a good inmate. You're in there because you are deemed a threat to other inmates and to staff. That's the reason that you're in there, that you're not someone that could be trusted with something sharp or something. It's a whole different type of ordeal that is housed in these solitary confinement blocks.
Interesting you mentioned that, because I know when I was talking to a Green Beret before you, I do another podcast on special forces, and one of my goals for all my podcasts is to try to bring out the truth, the reality, because we have a lot of people who advocate for things, God bless them, but they don't know anything about the world they're advocating. And when you have people who are attacking SHU, and I get their points in some arguments, they don't hear stuff like that. You just look at the other side, it's inhumane and all this other stuff. And sometimes you can tell me if I'm wrong, but sometimes people who are put in the shoe, it isn't because they're a threat to everybody else. It's because if they were put in the shoe, they'd be killed.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be a target, right? Is that possible too?
Yeah. And people don't know that even in the shoe, something can go wrong. Mm-hmm. And many people have lost their life in solitary confinement. You might say, the public might say, how does that happen? Aren't they supposed to be, behind doors all the time? Things happen. And when somebody wants something to happen, they can make that happen without no problem. And you're right. I go to, when I go in and speak with law enforcement and we go into schools, I was at a speaking engagement with the former ICE director, Tom Holman.
Oh, yeah.
And we were talking about, the crime that happens at the border with cartels and organized crime and all that. And those big moves that are happening, don't think that they're happening just from the people, the organized crime that goes on the outside. A lot of it has to do from someone that is sitting inside of a solitary cell that says, hey, we were brokers. We were apex predators. That's who's housed in these shoe units. And, it's a real world, and it's a dark world that a lot of the public, they have no clue. I like what you said, bless their hearts. they have no clue of the amount of danger that these inmates could put a hurting on a lot of people very easily.
It's interesting, Casey, because I know when I talk to intel guys in the CIA and whatnot, and then I look at the news and I look at other groups, and I'm looking going, you only have about 40% of the information. And I don't even get it all because I don't have that kind of top security clearance. And some of my guy friends who are in there in the CIA or the FBI, they don't, some of them don't have it, some of them do have it. And the ones who do just tell me, Carlos, you don't even know the half of it. So I look at this going, it's the same thing with your world, right? Or your former world. People would talk about things that they really don't even know half about. Or they get one or two people who, yeah, I just want somebody to visit me, so I'm going to tell them a bunch of stories.
Yeah.
Whatever fits their narrative. And now you make a great point on that. It's complicated. And maybe we'll get into it a little bit later on how the outside world meshes with the inside world of the prison, because there's definitely an open communication line there.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to you now. We're going to get into the moments of big moments for you. You were in SHU. I remember in the book, you didn't like it. You weren't happy at all. There are points where you seem to start really, you weren't losing it, but you could tell that your anxiety started going up from when I was reading your book. You started noticing other people having problems with it. I think there was another gang member in there you mentioned that really was having a hard time with it because he was trying to smear stuff on his body, feces, whatnot. So you started seeing that, but your anxiety really started picking up quite a bit, if I remember correctly.
I think that, you know, something starts to happen when you're in a, the walls definitely start, you know, getting, becoming alive. It seems like it becomes smaller and smaller. And if you don't have a strong will and mind, it'll take the best of them. You know, I share about this in a lot of places where I go talk. You know, I don't care how big you are. I don't care how tough you think you are. I've seen, you know, men that have 18, 19 inch arms, you know, drinking their own urine and losing their mind. I mean, you know, talking to themselves and standing on a wall on the corner of their cell, just talking to a wall, and they've lost it. So something happens, you know, in your brain, I think that you, and there's only, you know, there's only 8 cells in the top, 8 cells in the bottom. You can hear everything that goes on. And so when somebody loses it, we're all listening to someone lose it. When somebody's trying to commit suicide, we all listen to, you know, that man, that grown man that once led a gang and, you know, worked out with everybody. And the next thing you know, you could hear them running from the back of their cell to prison metal, trying to break their necks, trying to escape, you know, just trying to end it because they just can't handle the solitude in there. And I don't know about anxious. I think it was more like, you know, it affects you some way or another. I would say that, you know, seeing the guy next door to me, hallucinate and think that he has ducks in his cell, that'll, you know, he's right next door to you. So you're hearing all his activity. You know, he's talking to what he thinks is ducks. And so that definitely, it's not
you
like,
wonder,
what's that?
Did you start wondering, am I hearing somebody talking about ducks or am I starting to hear things that I'm not hearing?
No, you know what? Because we had conversations when I got in there, he had been there for 10 years already. He already had a decade in there in solitary confinement. And you got to remember that back then they can give you an indefinite SHU sentence, which meant, if you had a life sentence in there, you had a life sentence in the SHU if they wanted to. They left people in there for 20 years, you know, 30 years in there. So that's a long time in a single man cell. And again, back then, it wasn't two man cells. It was one single man cell. The whole SHU was. So That's a lot of time, man. That's a lot of time. And when I got in there, he was still in his right mind. You know, we had conversations. We talked about, you know, family here and there. You know, we knew what to talk about and what not to talk about. That's another thing. But we kept it very, you know, we were sociable with each other to a certain degree. But then, you know, from one day to the other, this guy, you know, and I thought he was playing around. I thought, you know, and what caught me off guard was you just don't, there's no joking around in an environment like that. Nobody, there's no goofing off. There's no, you stand guard at all moments. So for him, when I first hear him, you know, hallucinating, and I can hear him saying that he has ducks in his cell, I knew something had, someone turned off the lights on in his brain, and he was done. And it was from one day to the, it's like me talking to you right now, and tomorrow you're telling me, hey, you know, I got some ducks. You want one? And I would say to you, what are you talking about? You know, it was just like that. So yeah, that's, I think the idea crossed my mind. Is that going to happen to me? I tried to stay away from that idea. But yeah, you definitely, it's in your memory bank, and you're thinking about, you know, this was a solid dude, and now he's not. What do you do with that? You know?
Man, tough stuff. Again, folks, we're talking to Casey Diaz. The book is called The Shock Collar. Casey, I guess we're moving on, and I hope I don't take too much of your time. It's just such a fascinating story. I don't want to compare these two stories, but it's an interesting segue, because all of a sudden for you, you had a vision in the jail. I mean, the prison. There is a distinction, folks. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened here?
In this part, and usually I like leaving this part off to the readers.
Sure.
It's so detailed, and you know, there was a Baptist church that a prison ministry that would come last Thursday of the month for one visit, and they would go from cell to cell, you know, and they only had like about, you know, 4 minutes to 3 minutes to talk to these inmates and invite them to kind of like a Bible study kind of thing. And they would always come in through one way and exit out a different route. My cell, it's hard to explain how my cell was positioned on the last bit of it, because it's the last cell. And coming into the building, the cell door that would lead to outside would slide, and then there was still another gate in back of that. So if you're outside of that cell block, you could imagine a cell door sliding, and then bars right behind that and another door. So when that door swings open, it hides the last cell. So people are walking in there, they have no clue that there's a cell behind there. And when they leave, they're leaving through another exit or entrance. So for over a year and a half or so, this prison ministry has no clue that they have just walked right past me. And I'm not trying to grab their attention. I don't know who they are. I'm not paying attention to any of that. I know that they're there, but I'm not paying attention to it. And it was in this moment that, one of those moments that a little lady by the name of Frances decides to ask a CO, a correctional officer, if there was a cell behind that door, behind the gate, and is there a man in there? And, you know, the CO says, yeah, but you don't want nothing to do with that. And she's so persistent that, you know, this back and forth happens. And I didn't know that they were talking about me, you know, to be exact, because there was no mention of it. You know, you can't see outside out of your gate. So the second that I knew that they were talking about me is when he says, well, that's Diaz in there. And I'm the only Diaz on the block there. That's Diaz in there. You go ahead and approach a cell but I'm just letting you know you're wasting your time. And, you know, she approached my cell, and I could only see, like, her ankles, these, you know, through a little crack on my tray opening. She asked me how I was doing. I sarcastically said, couldn't be better. And I remember both of us, I had a little chuckle, and she, so did she, and she said, oh, that's a stupid question. I said, it's all good. So I gave her the respect, but I didn't want nothing to do with her invitation. And her persistence, man, was out of this world, you know. She tells me, you know, I'm going to put you on my hit list. That's a very colorful word to use in there. And she says, you know, I'm going to put you on my prayer hit list. And, you know, Jesus is going to use you. He loves you. He's going to use you. And this is the first time of me hearing somebody say that. And initially I'm thinking this lady has no clue who she's talking to and where she's at. I was very pompous and very prideful at the moment. You just like any young person, you think you know it all and you figured out life and everything else. And in that environment, you know, you just don't care about religion or anything like that. We never went to church growing up. I never got exposed to the gospel or anything like that. But in that cell, and she pursued, I mean, she came to that prison without skipping a beat the last Thursday of every month. And she would stop by, and she would always, before she left, she would always say, I'm still praying for you. And she called me by my first name, my real, my legal name, birth name, which is Darwin. And says, Jesus is going to use you. She would always say that. And I had a moment in that cell in which I saw on my wall what looked like a movie being played on an old, those movie reels, those old movie reels. And I started to see my whole life right in front of me being played from, from as a kid, and the first things that I ever did. We discussed this about earlier in this interview. What was the first crime that you did? It's the 7-Eleven thing that I could, as far back as I can remember. I think the 7-Eleven was the first time I actually tasted, crime, as far as, stealing something and knowing that I'm stealing something. So I see incidents that only I knew that had taken place in my life early being played. And the first thing that I thought was, that's it. The dude next door has ducks. And now I'm watching a movie here. That's it for me. That's my initial thought was, I'm done. That can't be real. This is not happening. But I start seeing this guy on a cross, carrying a cross, and then, people screaming at him, yelling at him. I knew that whoever was carrying this cross, no one liked him. And I get to see the whole staging, man, of what I know now is the gospel. And then it would shut down, and I would see, it would go back to my life. And it was very in order. There was nothing out of order. It was exactly how these things took place. And then I would see, my first stabbings, other things that I, unfortunately did, other crimes, and it was all in order. And then it would go back to this man with carrying this cross. And I got to see him being nailed to the cross and the cross raising. And then something really powerful happened. All this stuff, watching all this stuff, I didn't pay attention to as close enough as I should have, I think. But we come to this pivotal moment in what happened in that cell. And when I was around 8 years old, I always hated my birthday. You're in LA, you're being raised in LA. Darwin is not a cool name. Everybody else is Jose, Jason, Carlos, and then there's you, and you're Darwin. Nobody knows what the heck is that, right? So I remember we were playing outside, and I think I'm like 8 or 9, somewhere around there. And I tell the kids all around me, you know, from here on out, you're going to call me Casey. I don't know where I grabbed that name. I grabbed it, ran with it. And everybody agreed that they would be calling me Casey from that moment on. And the next thing I know, I've convinced a whole entire, you know, 15, 20 kids, and Casey is what they're calling me. And then my mom calls me Casey. I mean, to this day, my mom, my biological mom calls me Casey. She doesn't call me Darwin. My dad, everybody, uncles, cousins, I was referred to as that. So all this time up to that point in that cell, that's my name. And I see this guy on this cross, and I share this because I think that and I strongly believe that when Christ comes to your life, to anybody's life, he's going to come to you in a way that you understand him and what he's trying to do and the plan of salvation. And for me, I understood death. I understood the sounds of someone literally dying within arm's reach. That doesn't erase. And he's on the cross, and he says, "Darwin, I did this for you." And that was the moment that, I mean, nobody had to tell me how to pray. Nobody had to tell me any of that. It was almost something that was placed in there all along that I knew I had to deal. And I got on my knees in the middle of that cell, and I wept, man. I wept, like, I just wept. And I know that at that moment, it wasn't that I understood that what I had did all this time with all my crimes. It wasn't that I had did crimes. It was magnified. It was more than that. It was that I had sinned before God. That made my sin, what the Bible says, exceeding sinful. Like, that made sense to me in that moment. And until a person repents and understands that, you know, the sin that we're born sinners, until you have that moment by yourself with God, you're not going to understand even that part of the story, because it won't make sense until you've tasted what God has done on that cross, the redemption, the price that he paid, the ransom that he is for us, that he became for us. I mean, that when that starts to make sense, then you go, oh, you know, and you really don't even need an instructor. The Holy Spirit is now with you. And I think, I believe, strongly believe, and I know that's what it was, is that what drove me to my knees. And I remember saying, you know, God, and it was very raw. You know, God, I'm sorry for stabbing that guy in the eye. I'm sorry for stabbing that guy in front of his mom. All this, I mean, I was just being real, man. You know, and I think that when you get real with the Lord, and you know, what else could you do, man? It's not like you could hide from him. He knows all things, right? He knows all our secrets and everything. So it's kind of foolish to think that we can hide things from him. He knows everything. So I believe that while I was doing that, there was something that was being healed inside of me of. You know, it felt like a cleaning that was happening in that cell with my heart, and I had to make some decisions following that incident where I came to Christ that I knew I had to make, and well, I had no problem making those decisions made known to anybody and everybody in the system there.
Yeah, that was an amazing part of the book too, folks. And as Casey mentioned, we're not going to talk about everything in the book. But yeah, that part was tough. When you finally, when you ask God what to do, and he told you what to do, you did it. But it came with a lot of consequences. And it was interesting because your faith was challenged at one point. you buckled. And I wanted to ask you, not necessarily about that point in the faith, because I could see why. I could see why the frustration was going on there. And it was funny because I was waiting to see, when I was reading the book, I was waiting to see, is Casey going to talk about Job? Is Casey going to talk about Job? He didn't talk about Job. I was like, okay. But, you know, it reminded me too, because individuals who don't go the way you go, the way you went, okay, talk, the way you went, in the sense of finding God, sometimes I'll hear the opposite, which is, why weren't you there when my mom and dad were doing these things to me? Why weren't you there? Why did I end up with this life? Did you ever have that moment during the time when you started finding God? Did you ever say, why did you allow all this other stuff to happen? Couldn't I have learned a different way?
I don't remember a time of, and I think it has a lot to do with when I came to Christ, I owned my crimes. I knew that, no, these are decisions that I made. I got myself into this mess, and I owned every bit of it. So it wasn't society's fault. It wasn't the environment that I grew up in. It wasn't because, you know, politicians weren't doing their jobs. I didn't play the victim mentality. I owned every bit of my crime. And I mean, even when I went to the parole board on the time that I paroled, I had no clue that I was getting out. And in fact, when they asked me, why should we let you go home? Why should we parole you? My answer to them, and I don't know if they've ever had an inmate that told them that, but I remember telling them, you shouldn't. I don't deserve to ever be out. In fact, I think that what the court gave me, they should have just ended it for me. I should never get out for what I've done. And I don't think that they were ready to hear that. I think that that took them, I think that that just kind of threw a curveball at them. Because how do you answer that? How do you respond to that? As a parole board, this guy's not trying to get out. He's saying, I deserve to be in here. And I meant that, because I knew what I had committed. I knew what I was sentenced for. And I wasn't just that. I knew about the things that I, got away with, or at least I thought that I got away with. Those things, the things that, all the other stuff, man. So I didn't see myself as a victim. I saw myself as someone that, how can I complain about my situation right now when I've done so much to people and I've hurt people? I've done some horrible stuff to people, and yeah, there were gang members. Yes, there were. We could say, well, those were violent acts against other rival gang members. At the end of the day, they were human beings, and my hands did those things. And so, I think that I just never had a victim mentality. And a lot of that, I see that today in today's society, everybody plays that victim card. And I just don't buy it. You have choices. There was people that I grew up with that never got involved in gangs. Choices, You make a good choice, you get a good result. Make a bad choice, and you're gonna have to eat that some humble pie there.
Humble pie. You're absolutely right, because every time I tell people, when I do research or I talk about serial killers or things or pedophiles of that nature, when I explain their background, people think I'm trying to justify or play the victim card. I'm like, no. I just want to know, if we can discover the factors that can lead to this behavior, because if we can, then we can create preventative measures, hopefully, in the future. So if we know single parent homes are more challenging, if we know violence in the home increases the likelihood of committing intimate partner violence later in the future, we can work on those things early and try to stop those things. It isn't that, we're gonna give Carlos an excuse because he grew up in a violent home. Because, like as you said, Casey, it's kind of funny you mention it, because I always ask, a lot of times when I was lecturing, I always said, has anybody ever thought why certain people in these areas are not gang members, but yet they're in poor socioeconomic conditions with violence around them, and not everybody joins? doesn't work that way. Actually, a good friend of mine from LA Sheriffs, he grew up in an area filled with gangs. And an interesting comment he made, I don't know if you ever heard this. I'm going to backpedal for a second. I had to make this comment. When you said, I shouldn't get out, and just remembering seeing you saying that to Maximum John, yeah. I thought, all right, Casey, you might not get out after that one. But anyway, when my friend said to me, he said when he was hanging out with his friends, some were cousins, some were friends that were gang members, they told him not to get in. They said, you're not one of us. You shouldn't do this. You should go to school.
Wow.
Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, you know what? In fact,
oh no.
there's an episode that I shared, one of the early episodes in the that I share about. There was an individual in our gang who I don't believe in bad luck, but man, if it that exists, that guy had it. This guy had got stabbed multiple times on different times, been shot different moments. I mean, this guy had been stabbed I don't know how many times, and I remember that we got raided one evening. We're on the streets hanging out in our neighborhood, and the Rampart crash units came in and raided us, and we're running, and I ran a certain direction, and he followed me, and I told him, I said, don't go the other way, and he wanted to stick with me, and the route that I took, we were standing on top of a mechanic shop, a body shop, and you're agile when you're young, and it was a big jump. It was probably about maybe a 12-foot drop or whatever. And I ran and I jumped and I made it to the bottom without no problem. He had just got picked up the night before from the hospital from being stabbed. He had got stabbed, I don't know, like 15 times. And this guy's still wearing gauze, on his head.
Oh,
and he's in the neighborhood and he can't run. He's running, but he's not like running like I am. And I start running, towards the street, and the next thing I know, I turn around and this dude's screaming, because when he tried to make the jump, he landed on barbed wire, brand new barbed wire on the telephone post and on the lip of the wall of that mechanic shop, body shop, and he's hanging on barbed wire. And I turned around and I had to make a decision. Do I literally leave this guy hanging, or do I help him? And so I run back to him and I grab him by his leg, and I yank him down. So it's like shredded beef, man. And his arms are gone, man. And we made it across the street. I mean, it sounds like a silly story, but this really happened. And I remember we got into this abandoned building across the street, and we managed to walk about towards the back, and I think it was like maybe a flight and a half of stairs up, and we could hear the sirens and the helicopter and all that. So we stayed there, and he's just bleeding profusely all over the place. And I remember having this talk with him, and I said, hey man, I just don't think this is for you, brother. I think that you need to do something else other than this, because look, I'll co-sign for you moving on, bro. I don't think this is for you, that kind of thing. Could you imagine somebody telling you, you're just not made for this, go to school or go learn something, but this is not for you. And I don't know what happened to homeboy, this actually happened. And so yeah, I was a trying to tell somebody, do something else rather than gangbang here in LA. It's just not, you're not me.
Oh man. I guess if there's a, you remember Clouseau?
Who?
Clouseau, the Pink Panther.
No. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like the Pink Panther of gangs, I guess.
The Pink Panther of gangs, yeah.
Oh, man, that's a crazy story. Well, I guess in our last few minutes together, and thank you so much for taking the time, too, Casey, for doing this. I know you're a busy guy. Again, folks, the book is called The Shot Caller. The podcast is called The Shot Caller. Make it easy for you. Casey Diaz, in our last few minutes together, I wanted to kind of bounce around. I know we're wrapping up the story there, and I guess it's great for people to go now and buy the book and find out what happens. You have a lot of stuff going on when you finally converted, and then you went, what happened to you when you did say that, how they treated you, and then you had some incredible miracles throughout your time because you kept moving from one place to another. You made some friends in there. I think Abel was one of them.
Yeah.
And then you had another experience when you got out. So that was fascinating too, at least for the first 24 hours when you got out. And you were doing some work already quickly when you got out too. One of the things, I guess, 1 Corinthians comes to mind, 1 Corinthians 10, right? God doesn't give you anything you can't handle. Did you ever get to that? Did you ever see that in your head when you were going through some of the stuff after you converted and became saved? Did you say that to yourself? Like, God doesn't give me more than I can handle. God doesn't give me more than I can handle.
You know, I had moments in there where you I don't know if it doubt, I think it's more of a, and it's not regret. You almost feel like God just bamboozled you in some kind of way. Right. Because, you know, and I remember saying this in one incident, you know, because, man, I was getting some pretty beatings that I shouldn't be doing this interview right now in my right five. I mean, that's just that's how brutal they were. But I remember telling God, you know, I did this for you. I did all this for you. I gave up all of this, you know, and this is what I get. You know, I remember having that, and it's almost like an argument with God, right? And then, you know, God has a way of putting you in your place when you hear him telling you, no, you didn't give up everything for me. I gave up everything for you. And then you kind of go, okay, let me be quiet and let me gather my thoughts here a little bit better, because, you know, that's the reality. God gave everything for us. You know, whatever we have, whatever we give up, that should have been, that's just automatic. But, you know, so yeah, there was moments where frustration came in, when there was no pity parties that I had. It was just, you know, when is this going to stop kind of thing, you know, because the beatings were right after the other. And it wasn't just me, just to, you know, for the record, there was other Christians that, you know, came through me witnessing, and they had to endure just the same, and some even much more than what I had to go through through that time. I think I had a great conversation with someone from a very good friend of mine that who's also a Christian now, and he was in the Pelican Bay Shoe, and we had a good conversation. And one of the things that we were commenting on was, you know, everything that we got, we had coming, all of it, you know, so we couldn't complain about, you know, we got beat again, you know, what was me, you know, that we had it coming. I mean, what do you expect, you know? And I think that I know that reading the stories of Paul and Peter and Stephen and all these godly men that had absolutely no problem with giving up their own lives for the gospel's sake, that really encouraged every single one of us to, you know, hey, we were willing to die for a neighborhood. How much more for this gospel? If that's what it's going to take, then that's what it's going to take. I remember sitting with getting a haircut one time with one of my one of the guys that came to Christ, and he's cutting my hair, and he says this to me. He says, you think we're gonna make it out alive out of this place? You know, and that was like out of nowhere, right?
Yeah.
He says, you think we're gonna make it out alive out of this place? And I said, regardless of what happens, we make it out alive out of this place. And it took him a second to actually understand what I was saying. That regardless of whether we die in this prison, because, you know, somebody takes our life, because we're simply serving Christ in here, you know, we understand the scriptures, then we come out alive regardless, whether paroled or, you know, by losing our life. So there was great comfort in the fellowship that I had, that we all had in there with those that came to Christ during that time.
It's a great, great story. And I guess in our last couple of minutes, take it away from the book for a second. What are some of the things you could share with people that you want to kind of straighten out about prison? What's one myth, I guess, that pops up to you that says, no, this isn't true about prisons that you want to tell people? And then maybe you can give us your message to people who are in gangs today.
I think the false narrative of loyalty in gangs or in organized gang activity, there is no such thing. There is absolutely no such thing as loyalty. I don't care if you grew up with somebody. It could be your cousin. It could be a relative that you admire in there, and you're in the same, situation with them. And there is absolutely no loyalty in any gang activity whatsoever. You will see right off the bat how you quickly people will forget you, and they won't care anything about you being in there. And the cause is you losing so much valuable time. I talked to one of my buddies out here who I led to the Lord as well. And, some of the things that we share is, how much further we would have been in life had we known the Lord, a lot sooner. Could we have avoided all this? And the answer is no, because this is our portion. This was our cup, and we needed to go through this in order to understand and be thankful for what we do have now, and do the best of it, and be a voice to warn everybody, especially kids nowadays, that they're hearing rap songs about violence, about carrying guns, and sleeping around, and all that. Most of your rappers, if not all of them, they've never been one day inside of a solitary confinement cell. It's all makeup. It's all, it's a show. It's a show. They've never done it themselves. Otherwise they wouldn't be singing and making millions out here. So it's all it's a waste of time. And what I would say to the young people that are either in gangs or contemplating and joining gangs, don't do it. Just don't do it. I don't care how high up the rank that you'll ever reach, it is absolutely not worth it. It's not one day worth you serving one day in a jail cell or in a prison cell. You will waste valuable time, and you're worth much more than that. You're valuable. I think that's what it is, man. People are valuable. And if you never heard somebody tell you that you're valuable, I'm telling you, your life really matters, and you can do something so awesome and unique, and you're designed to make something awesome and unique that no one else can but you. There's only one of you, and use that. Use the gift and the talent that God has put inside of you. Go looking for a church that teaches the Bible. Go hang out with healthy people that'll pour into your life. Listen to that police officer that's trying to tell you you're doing the wrong thing, listen to them and respect them, and know that they're not telling you that because they're telling you that because they understand that you're wasting your time in the life of crime. It never pays, and you will regret ever spending 1 minute incarcerated. It's not worth it.
Great message. I think we can wrap it up there. Casey Diaz, the book called The Shock Collar, the podcast called The Shock Collar. Thank you so much, Casey, for being here.
Man, thanks so much for having me. And, you know, it's an honor to be on your podcast.
It was an incredible conversation, my friend. Incredible conversation. God bless. Thank you, everyone. Make sure to share, subscribe, hit that like button. Hey, if you're on Apple, hit those 5 stars. Thanks, everyone.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.